Hello. I'm Barbara Epler of New Directions, the proud publisher of the works of Javier Marías in the United States. And I'd like to thank the New York Public Library and Paul Leclerc, and especially Paul Holdengraber, for being our host this evening and for this evening's conversation with Javier Marías. I've been asked to make two brief introductions. Paul Holdengraber, after being a professor at Princeton and the founder of the Institute for Art and Cultures at L.A. County Museum of Arts, has for the last half dozen years been the director of the public education program at the New York Public Library, as well as the host of the New York Public Library Live series, a series dedicated to the idea that thinking and reading are a source of joy. My aim, he has said, is to send oxygen sweeping through the library. Passionate about ideas, deeply read, and wonderfully nimble, Paul has also said that, quote, my purpose is not only to make the lions roar, but to trigger people's imaginations. It's not only sex that is exciting, but the life of the mind. When you come into contact with a great idea, it can change your life. Born in Madrid in 1951, the son of anti-Franco intellectuals, Javier Marías spent time in Wellesley and New Haven as a young boy when his father, the philosopher Julian Marías, took teaching posts abroad. His parents referred to Javier as the American baby. He published his first novel at 19, and in the 1980s, while publishing more of his own books, he translated works from Faulkner, Hardy, and Stern, and John Ashbery, among many other authors, and he also taught at Wellesley and Oxford. For the last two decades, he's been a full-time writer, and his novels have won scores of prizes, including the Dublin Impact International Prize, and have been translated into 38 languages. 6 million copies of his books have been sold worldwide, which is an astonishing amount for so literary a writer. He also writes a column every Sunday for El País. His novels are extraordinary and like no one else's. And one, Tomorrow in the Battle, Think on Me, begins, no one ever expects that they might someday find themselves with a dead woman in their arms, a woman whose face they'll never see again but whose name they'll remember. No one ever expects anybody to die at the least opportune moments, even though this happens all the time. Seafood poisoning, a cigarette lit as the person is drifting off to sleep that sets fire to the sheets, or even worse, to a woolen blanket. A slip in the shower, the back of the head, the bathroom door locked. A lightning bolt that splits into a tree planted in a broad avenue. A tree which, as it falls, crushes or slices off the head of a passerby. Possibly a foreigner, dying in your socks or at the barber's, still wearing a voluminous smock, or in a whorehouse or at the dentist, or eating fish and getting a bone stuck in your throat, choking to death like a child whose mother isn't there to save him. And that list goes on for another page. We shouldn't forget, Javier Marías is an author who's warned listening is the most dangerous thing of all. So you've been warned. And I just want to say we're here to celebrate the triumphant conclusion of Your Face Tomorrow. It's the third volume, Poison, Shadow, and Farewell, which was published 3 days ago. A couple of the reviews from the UK. It becomes impossible to resist the thought that this deeply strange creation, with its utterly sui generis methods, its brilliant disquisitions on love and loss, its dark playfulness, may very well be the first authentic literary masterpiece of the 21st century. That was James Lasden in the UK Guardian. And Anthony Beevor in the Telegraph says, this is the final and the most powerful part of Javier Marías' monumental trilogy, Your Face Tomorrow. Together, the three volumes constitute one of the great novels in modern European literature. We hope you enjoy tonight's discussion between these two Europeans. One is taken to America like a duck to water, and the other is intensely and thoroughly European. Yesterday, on the subject of religion as a powerful political force in American politics, Javier turned to me and said, well, at moments to Europeans, you Americans seem like Martians. He would not come here while Bush was in office, and New Directions takes a great personal satisfaction in finally getting him here after 20 years. Please give Paul Holdengraber and this very great novelist a very warm Martian, American, New York welcome.
Thank you very, very much, Barbara, and thank you very much, Flash. It's a great, great pleasure to have you here, and I'm happy that we have a new
The pleasure is mine.
It can't be all yours. We have to share.
No, I didn't say all mine. I just said mine.
That's true. But I'm glad we have a different president to offer you.
Yes. Yes, why not?
I'd like to start our conversation tonight on the subject of translation, which is a subject that you are deeply interested in, I think. And one of the things you've said, which is very simple, and I've never heard anyone say it before, which is that when we read a book in translation, mm-hmm. we are not reading a single word written by that author. Mm-hmm. It's quite an astounding fact. And
yeah, it's like that. You know that Borges said that translation was a modest mystery, but one of the biggest in the universe. And I think he was right, at least in some aspects. If you come to think of it, it's quite absurd that anything can be translated and still be the same thing as it was.
But it isn't.
In translation, when you translate a book, the book loses the language that made it possible. It loses absolutely each and every word, literal word, I mean, the author imagined, the author thought of, the author chose. In the case of poetry, you lose normally, very easily, you lose rhyme and meter. In the case of prose, very often you lose the pace of the prose or the rhythm or whatever you want to call it. And still we think that we are reading the same book as Tolstoy wrote, for instance, if we read War and Peace, I mean, except maybe some Russian professor at a university who would say, oh, no, you haven't read War and Peace because you never read it in Russian. We all tend to think that we did read War and Peace. But the truth is that if we could have Tolstoy here and we gave him a copy of War and Peace in English or in Spanish, he wouldn't know what that was. He wouldn't know, as it happens to myself as well. I mean, when I receive, for instance, a copy of one of my books translated into, say, Croatian or Hindi or Korean, I'm in great difficulty to know where my name is on the cover. And say, well, this could be my name. This could be the title. Maybe this, the dedication. But I really don't know where they are. So it's true that every single word has been changed, and that the wording of a translation has never been chosen by the author, but by the translator.
But you also believe, to go further than that comment, which struck me, because I never really thought of it quite that way. It's a very mm-hmm. simple comment,
yeah.
And yet, in some way, I think it actually alerts you to the fact that you're reading something in a strange and different language. It sort of puts in perspective Flaubert's comment about le mot juste. Mm-hmm. There's no mot juste, no correct word in the translation in some way. And yet you also believe that translation is one of the most creative endeavors, and you believe that perhaps the best book you ever really did was Tristram Shandy's Laurence Sterne, the translation of
Yeah, because Tristram Shandy is much better than anything I wrote myself. I only rewrote it.
Right. That's what you said to us when we were upstairs in the rear book room.
Yeah, because a translator is something that's sometimes forgotten, that many people have said that a translator is a really privileged reader, which is true, because, you know, translator must read very carefully, etc. But he's also a very privileged writer, if he's translating something good, of course. The fact of rewriting a great text like Tristram Shandy or like The Mirror of the Sea by Joseph Conrad, as I did in the past, or Sir Thomas Browne, or Thomas Hardy or Stevenson or so many others is really a privilege, and you learn a lot by doing that. You learn, if you do it acceptably in your own language, you've learned a lot. You have tuned your instrument, which is language. You have polished your tool, and if you are capable of doing that acceptably, you've already done a lot and you've learned a lot. On the other hand, there is another very good thing in translation for a would-be writer or for a writer, which is that you have to renounce to your own style if you have one, and try to imitate someone else's style. In that sense, you are like an actor, like a British actor. Not quite like an American actor. Sometimes, you know. Sometimes it's been said that British actors act, American actors are. It's not quite the case in all.
But it's a bon mot.
Yeah,
it is a bon mot.
And a British actor sometimes does that. I mean, he erases himself, as it were, in order to really be at the service of the character he's playing. And that's what a translator does as well. I mean, you have to erase any trace of your own style, if you have one, in order to reproduce someone else's, and normally someone who is much better writer than you.
What does that do to the notion of originality?
Pardon?
What does that do to the notion of originality, then, in that moment when you're translating?
What do you mean, what does it do?
Well, in some way, if you have to make your voice cease to have a style of its own, and you have to simply be at the service of someone else.
Well, that's not bad at all. That's not bad at all. Even in your own writing, that's not bad at all. I think that originality is one of the most overestimated things in life. And it's a very dangerous thing, in my opinion, for a writer, for instance, and generally for artists of all kind. Originality is very prestigious, but I think that's something you happen to be original. You happen to be. You can't decide beforehand that you are going to be very original. Many people do, and they usually write disasters, I must say. I think it's very overvalued, and yeah. I think that certainly a young writer, someone who is beginning, should be rather more modest, and I think it's a good thing to have models and to try to emulate. That's a good word that no one ever uses anymore. I don't know in English, but certainly in Spanish we have the same verb, emular. Nobody uses it anymore, and I think that some very young people don't even know what it means. And it's not imitation, it's not certainly plagiarizing or anything of the sort.
But it's
emulating, it's trying to do as best as you can what you admire most.
It's kind of a pastiche of sorts.
No, not necessarily. I mean, if emulation is try to be as good as something you really admire, you really love. And to begin with, I mean, certainly if you do that all the time throughout a very long career when you're 80, well, that might be a problem. But when you're starting and when you're young, I think that's a very good thing to do. And that's a very good way of learning too. And it's a way of not try to be original. I mean, you happen to be original, I think. But you can't decide that you're going to be very original.
And you can't say it for yourself. It's as if a saint all of a sudden said, I'm a saint. It would kind of disqualify them.
For instance.
Walter Benjamin, in The Task of the Translator, says that in translation, the original rises into a higher and purer linguistic air. I wonder if you agree with that comment.
A higher?
Air. Ear.
Oh, air.
Air. Mm. Now we'll get to ear because you.
Well, what Walter Benjamin wrote about translation was very, very interesting, but that particular sentence is a bit solemn, isn't it?
I'll give you less solemn ones in a minute, and I have one actually that he quotes. Now, what did you you chose to
One thing interesting, okay. If you allow me.
Of course.
One interesting thing that I think he said, because I haven't reread that text in a long time, is, and I absolutely agree with that one, is that the moment you know one language, just one language besides your first language, you realize how incomplete all languages are, and you start missing what the other language has, and when you speak the other language, you are missing what your own language has. And to give you an example, which I used, I remember when I taught theory of translation in Oxford and also in Wellesley College and in Madrid in the 1980s. And I remember I used to say to my students two contradictory things the very first day. And I said, translation is impossible and everything can be translated. And then I gave them some examples of, and I said, listen, for instance, in England, in English, there are so many verbs to describe different ways of looking that we don't have in Spanish. In English, you have to look, of course, to gaze, to glance, to stare, to peep, to peer, to, I don't know, others, I can't remember right now. And we don't have that in Spanish. In Spanish, we have to add an adverb to mirar, which is to look, and then mirar fijamente or mirar whatever, which is really poor in comparison. But, for instance, Spanish has a huge richness of diminutives and suffixes. And, for instance, the word tonto, which means silly or fool, has a series of, I mean, every Spaniard, I think, can tell the nuance and the difference between tonto, just like that, and tontín, and tontuelo, and tontaco, and tontazo, and tontorrón, and tontaina, and tontaina.
You're looking at me, yes.
No, I'm not.
No. I just, you know, I mean, I understand.
Yeah, and tontaina.
Yeah.
And tontazo, and all of them are different, and even some of them are very sweet ways of addressing someone.
Thank you.
Yeah, absolutely. And then you don't have that, I'm sorry, but you don't have that in English, and on some occasions even, to put another example about diminutives, sometimes it's not only impossible to translate that, but it's even impossible to explain exactly that. For instance, we don't say that very much in Spain, but in Mexico and in other Latin American countries, they often say ahorita, which means now, but in a diminutive, with a diminutive, which is absurd. If you come to explain, it's a now, but said diminutively. For an English-speaking person, say, what's he saying? And then there's even the ahoritita, which is a double diminutive, which is still more harder to explain. So Benjamin was right when he said, you realize that no language is complete. You have a nostalgia of the Ursprache, I think he said,
yeah.
of the primitive, the language that probably
before,
was before Babel, Babel yeah. or Babel. You say Babel or Babel
I don't know.
English?
I mean, there's a song about, say, you say tomato, I say tomato. You know, let's call the whole thing off. But
I must say Babel, no?
Babel, I don't know. I'm a linguist.
The Tower of Babel? Good. Thank you, sir.
You see, it's even difficult to speak.
Absolutely.
With all those difficulties and the ones you presented to your students about translation, when you translated Tristram Shandy, I'm taking that example in particular, what was the most difficult part of it? What was really difficult? And if you remember what was difficult in it, do you remember any examples in particular where you really struggled with giving?
I don't think I could. The problem is that I did translate Tristram Shandy about 32 years ago, something like that, when I was very young, which speaks once more about youth's irresponsibility. And and boldness, certainly. But that was quite a long time. I suppose that some of the most difficult parts had to do with the puns. And of course, I tried to convey the same pun. I remember I was very lucky. But this is too long and complicated. When he speaks about a cock and bull story, then by one of those miracles of languages, there is an expression in Spanish that is not the exact equivalent at all. But it's cross. So let's. It's a cross expression. So it's.
We're in a library.
No. It would be too long, and it would be going into Spanish words. But I was sometimes there are miracles with languages. Say, come on. I mean, this pun is translatable itself. Sometimes I had to write a footnote explaining. One thing I have noticed as a translator when I was one is that some authors are not so difficult to translate because their prose or their poetry, I never wrote poetry, but I have translated some poetry, and not easy poetry. I did translate Wells Stevens, for instance, or John Ashbery, or Nabokov's poems, or Faulkner's poems, and one of the things you realize is that some authors are not very difficult in the end, because they have music in their prose or in their poetry, and if you jump up into that music, if you can say that in English,
can you? I mean, you can.
Well, I was improvising my English right now. Then it takes you all the way, as it were. Whereas others, as good as the former, don't have that. I translated Yeats, prose by Yeats. He doesn't have that in his prose. Stern has it. And then once I took the train of his music, as it were, I was carried by it.
And your translation of Stern was not only a translation into Spanish, but you added some 1,000 footnotes.
Yeah, many of which, of course, I took from the British and American editions because it was absurd to try to find out about things that somebody else had already found out.
But some were not.
Some were not, yes. And, of course, many had to do with the puns and all that. And I found, you know, I experienced then how scholars must feel, because if there was not a note about a certain Swiss obscure clockmaker in the 15th century, and there was not a note in the American or British editions, I decided that I would try and find who that man was. And on some occasions, I did.
This naturally quite the jump from Stern to the next subject I'd like to investigate with you is to the importance of digression for you and the importance of digression in your novels. As Stern has one of my favorite comments about digression, he says that something to the effect that digression is the sunshine of narrative. Mm-hmm. And actually, there was a moment when I was teaching, as Barbara
I think
was
he
saying,
also said it was a grain of salt or something like that.
He may have. Mm. But I remember wanting to teach a course on digression, and I only knew the first line of the course, which was, this is a course on digression, but before we begin. I never got really to teaching that class, but a psychoanalyst I very much like, named Adam Phillips, in a book called Side Effects, says that digression is secular revelation. And he says that things said off topic, things that fall, as it were, out of your pocket, mm-hmm. is, according to him, where real action and feeling lies. And I'm wondering if, to some extent, this couldn't be said about your work, that you have a propensity or a proclivity at moments in your narrative simply to slow things down so much that they nearly come to a stand still.
And to the irritation of conventional readers, too, I'm afraid. Yes, I think that one of the most wonderful things that a novel can do, and perhaps not so much any other kind of art, and probably not any other literary genre, is that it can give time its real duration. By its real duration, I mean, of course, time's real duration is 1 minute lasts 60 seconds and all that. But that happens in real life. That's the way it is, of course. But I would say that time doesn't give time the time to really exist. But if we, that's happened to everyone, if we come to think of the way we remember time, remember something important or not so important, for instance, imagine that you've been discussing for a whole night with your girlfriend or who is leaving you, for instance, and that was a very long night, and there were all kinds of arguments and discussions and beggings and whatever. A long night, you know. And
One of those.
And after that, probably when time passes, it's very likely that you remember of that very long night, you remember just one gesture, one look, one sentence, the moment when you thought you could save that relationship, something very short, and only that. And the rest has been absolutely erased from your memory. And then that's the real duration of things, in my opinion. But in real time, in actual time, in actual present time, we never notice that. We can't. We can't because, as I said, time doesn't give time to have its real duration.
What does that say about our memory?
What
does that say about our memory? Because I've always liked the.
I think it says that our memory is the one who gives. It's the one giving time its real duration, and selecting what things or what moments even were important really, and then you can have that in a novel as it happens. In a novel, you can do that. In a novel, you can have things happening and having the duration they never have in real life. That's what I. And then, for instance, in the second volume of Your Face Tomorrow, there is a scene, a very long scene, in fact, in which a man, the narrator's boss, who is a man working for a rather obscure group at the service of the MI6, that is the British Secret Service for abroad. Brings out a sword in a handicapped toilet at a disco in London in present day, which is very, very, very absurd and very rare. And then he's about to strike or to behead someone who is there. A real moron, by the way. So the reader is afraid of that happening, but not so afraid. And then, the very impatient conventional reader will want to know whether that moron is going to be beheaded or not by Tupra, which is the name of the character.
Yes, and so what do you do?
But then, instead of that, what comes is a long reflection about swords and why a sword is so scary nowadays. Much more than a gun, probably. And what's been the meaning of a sword? And its comparison to an arrow or a spear or a lance, because, you know, one thing that a sword has or had is that you throw an arrow and the arrow may hit the target or not, but you have to use another arrow in case you want to try again. Whereas a sword, you never let it loose. You can strike once and again. It can be unending, which is very scary. And then there are some reflections about that, and etc. And then there are also some flashbacks, because the narrator remembers some things his father told him that happened during the Civil War. And then we go back to the handicapped toilet, and then for a while, but only for a while. And I think the whole thing lasts about 150 pages.
So why do you...
To my discharge, you say that in English? To my discharge? In my discharge? No, you don't say that.
To my defense. Yes.
Yeah. That particular piece is also a tribute or a wink to Cervantes. There is a moment in Don Quixote in which Don Quixote and a character called the Biscayne or del Vizcaíno are about to strike each other with their swords. And then there is an interruption in the story, and Cervantes goes to something else. And you expect him to come back to those two swords up in the air, and he doesn't. He never does. So those two swords have been for 400 years now.
There.
And they shall ever be. What is worse, they shall ever be there. So, in a way, I was not so bold or daring. Cervantes had done a much worse thing. In the end, the sword in my novel does come down.
So you slightly improved on Cervantes.
No, on the contrary.
What I'm curious about is why you do this. In some way, are you telling the reader, you know, festina lente, just wait, hurry slowly, take your time,
sure,
pay attention,
sure,
and if I irritate you, learn the value of being irritated, because there is something for you to gain. There is virtue in difficulty.
Yes, somehow. But at the same time, I hope that the digressions, even if they initially may irritate a conventional reader or an impatient one, that the digressions in themselves are interesting enough for him or for her to forget after a couple of pages about the sword, that particular sword in this character Tupra's hands, and be interested in what the narrator is telling in that digression. I want it all to be as interesting as the apparently most interesting things. Action, plot, they seem to be very interesting, but I'm not sure they are so interesting by themselves. As a reader, and of course I'm much more of a reader than of a writer, because I read and I have read many more books than I shall ever write. That happens to all authors. As a reader, yeah, sometimes I can be very interested reading a book and what's going to happen, and now... And sometimes that's marvelously done. I don't disdain at all that kind of narrative.
And I would try.
But the problem is that normally, if you only have that, a very fascinating storyline or plot, that fascination lasts normally only while you're reading, and not after you finish the book. Once you close the book, you start forgetting everything about the plot. That happens to me, and I think that happens to many other people. And I don't even remember how that book or that film even ended. So I can watch it again on TV, for instance, because I can't remember what happened in the end, because in the end it's quite unimportant. Whereas there are another kind of novels in which the plot is only a bait for the reader to go on somehow, but there are more things. There is an atmosphere which you will remember once you have closed the book, once you have finished and closed it. There is some reflections, some literary thoughts that made you stop while you were reading. Sometimes I stop when I'm reading Shakespeare, when I'm reading Proust, when I'm reading Thomas Bernhardt and I say, what? What's he saying? And it's not the plot or the storyline that made me stop. It's a wonderful flash, something really inspiring, something they said at a given moment, and or something extremely beautiful. There is, for instance. Oh, I'm sorry.
No. There is, for instance. Go ahead.
It is, for instance, Your Face Tomorrow has a system of quotations too. There are several quotations by different authors. In order not to be pedantic, the narrator doesn't say normally whom they belong to, but as he doesn't want to, I don't want to appropriate things from others. Every time he quotes something, he says, "I quoted to myself. I quoted to myself." And there is, for instance, one by Shakespeare, which is so beautiful, and it's very short. He says, speaking about, he says, "Bloody and guilty, guiltily awake." That repetition of "guilty" as an adverb, I think it's wonderful, and gives you absolutely the idea of someone sleepless, guiltily, bloody and guilty, guiltily awake. And it has, say, you stop and say, "What? This is wonderful." And some books.
So the stopping is
is interesting.
And that's a part. I mean, it's like the seeking of pleasure on a body you love. You stop. Linger.
Or when you listen to music and then you want to listen to the same music again, for instance.
So it's the pleasures of lingering in some way.
Absolutely, in my opinion, that's very important. Also in literature, and also in novels, even. I have nothing against novels of action or just plot and just. Well, mine do have a plot. Now people are going to think that.
No.
Mine are only lingering and more lingering, which is not exactly the case. I mean.
No. There's much more than lingering. I promise you. Get the books. They're absolutely wonderful. You know. Since you didn't particularly like my first quotation of Benjamin, I'm going to give you another one which may please you more. I thought of it when reading you, because I think that Proust's way of writing certain letters that Benjamin quotes here made me very much think of your novels, and I'll be reading a little passage of it to illustrate
this.
In a wonderful essay by Benjamin, called "The Image of Proust," he writes, "Proust did not tire of the training which moving in aristocratic circles required. Assiduously and without much constraint, he conditioned his personality, making it impenetrable and resourceful and submissive and difficult, as it had to be for the sake of that mission. Later, on this mystification ceremoniousness, he became so much part of his letters that sometimes they constitute whole systems of parentheses, and not just in the grammatical sense, letters which, despite their infinitely ingenious, flexible composition, occasionally call to mind the specimen of a letter writer's handbook. My dear Madame, I just noticed that I forgot my cane at your house yesterday. Please be good enough to give it to the bearer of this letter. P.S. Kindly pardon me for disturbing you. I just found my cane."
Yeah, well, you could also interpret that of course, he might not have sent the note in the end. I don't know if you mean that I might not have written my books in the end.
No.
But it's possible. I mean, I might not have written them. No book is ever necessary. Absolutely, no book is ever necessary. I mean, this history of the world would be exactly the same as it is without our having had even Shakespeare or Cervantes. Would be the same one.
Really?
I think so, yeah. Oh, if we didn't have any of them, if we didn't have Montaigne and if we didn't have, no, then it would be different. But if we,
so
if we didn't
have
one.
Limit. But yeah. Really, it would make you, though, it would make many of us, I think it would make many people in this audience, I would imagine, different people. If they
I said the world would be the same, not the people, or not certain people. But the whole of the world would be exactly the same one, without any of them.
Which would lead us quite naturally to
maybe
ask...
not without Homer. What? who started everything, as you know. That's the only doubt I have about that. But anyway, my books certainly are not necessary at all. In fact, I can't withdraw them now anymore. I can't do that. Though I could have done it with the third volume, for instance. I was tempted at a given moment to not to finish the third volume, but that would have been a different thing.
And when you finish a book, are you on to the next project?
No. The problem, one of the problems with my way of looking at literature and my way of writing is that I never had a project, not a big literary project for sure. And in fact, whenever I finish a novel, I don't even know if there shall be another one. And I'm very happy without when I don't write. I mean, I don't need that. Those pompous words sometimes writers use, I rather dislike them because I think they are a bit false. And I don't think there is a real necessity. Or if there is, I don't know, maybe you should go to a shrink or something. But I live happily, reasonably happily. If I'm not writing, I wait. If something comes to my mind after a couple of years, then and I feel like writing again something, then I start. But
so do you?
But I don't even know whether there shall be a new novel once I finished one, and in particular with this one, which has been so long, it took me about 8 years of my life, and. Well, I had the feeling that when I finished the third volume, that I had emptied myself in a way, and that I, at least in the field of the novel, maybe I didn't have anything else to say, which was okay. I mean, it was all right. I've started a new one now, sure. A shorter one.
You said that very quietly, but everybody heard.
Yeah, well, I don't know, because I mean, after 8 years with the same characters and in the same world, I see these new characters from in this novel I'm writing at present as almost intruders and newcomers and strange people, and who are they and who knows them in comparison with the others with whom I spent such a long time, you know. So I feel very insecure. I'm not sure I care about them very much, which is a bad thing, not to care about your characters. But maybe I do more than I think at present.
You're very interested in ghosts.
Ghosts?
Yeah.
Yeah. Literary ghosts.
Why?
It's not that I believe in them.
No, you don't.
I pretend I do sometimes, but.
I like
ghost stories and I like ghosts in literature or in films as well. Yes, they are. And as I said a few days ago, I think they are marvelous narrators. Ghosts, they have to be.
Because they're omniscient.
Well, it depends on the ghost. Not all ghosts are omniscient, you know. Do you know they all are omniscient?
No. I rely on your information.
Yeah, well, no. Some are not, I think. No, but the idea is, if you come to think of it, that's a very good point of view to tell a story. A ghost is someone who has passed away already, to whom nothing can happen. Because everything that had to happen to him or to her did already happen. But at the same time, he's not someone indifferent. I mean, someone who is out of the story in a way, but at the same time, he's not indifferent. Precisely ghosts, what they do is to haunt, to come back, to try and help the people they loved, to try and harm the people who harmed them or they hate. They are anything but indifferent to the story they witness, to the story they tell. And I think that's a marvelous point of view for a writer. I think that writers, it's not easy, but writers should write their books as if they were already dead. That would be the best possible point of view. And then you know the end of the story, really, if you're dead or if you're a ghost.
I'd love to give a little bit of a flavor of one of the short stories you have in this marvelous mm-hmm. collection called When I Was Mortal. And the story that bears that title begins with, I often used to pretend I believed in ghosts, and I did so blissfully, but now I am myself a ghost. I understand why, traditionally, they are depicted as mournful creatures who stubbornly return to the places they knew when they were mortal. And one question that comes to mind very quickly to me is, who is this I? Because your narrators are so surprising.
Who is this I in that story?
That story.
Oh, the narrator? Well, afterwards he tells part of his story. So you know a few things about him. It's only a story, it's not a novel, so not much is told. But what he says is precisely that particular one is omniscient, and he remembers, and he says that his curse now is that he remembers everything and he knows everything that he didn't know while he was alive. And that's a subject which is very interesting for me, and I've talked about it in some of my novels. People tend to want to know. They want to know things, and if they have a suspicion of something, the immediate thing to do is try to dispel that suspicion by knowing, by finding out about that. And one of my novels, A Heart So White, deals partly with the possibility that secrecy is a rather convenient thing, and that sometimes it's better to... You have to be very courageous to decide, in order to decide not to know something that is important or may be important for you. But how sometimes that's important, and it's better not to know things. And in this short story, what the narrator says is, now I know everything, and I can't be innocent anymore, as I was when I was mortal. Now I know that what I thought in my childhood that happened with a very good doctor who came home and when I was ill was a terrible story.
My father
and now I
listened
know,
to records of yeah, things and, were happening. During
yeah,
that time.
And now I know how I was killed, because I didn't even know who was killing me with a hammer. Because I was killed, if I remember well, it has a few years. He was killed by someone with a hammer, and he was sleeping, and he just felt the hammer blow on his forehead. But he didn't know who was doing that, and what is worse, who had ordered it. So he says, well, it's benign. That's life was benign in comparison to what I know now, what I now know. He is a narrator. That's the I, and that's why he feels so miserable, because he remembers everything and knows everything, even what he didn't know in life.
So would your comments imply that we deceive ourselves?
Well, don't we? Absolutely. That's one of the subjects also of your face tomorrow, and the very title has to do with that. The main example of that. I mean, we would like to know. We normally think that we know the people we care, the people we love, the people who are close to us. Their faces today. We think we know how they are, what we can expect from them. But we certainly don't know how their faces will be tomorrow. Of course, metaphorically speaking, faces. We don't know that. And we wish we knew. And sometimes I think that everyone has had this feeling of, oh dear, this person is the last one from whom I would have expected this or that. And I don't know if in English you say I would have put my hand on the fire for him or for her. You say that? Put your hand on the fire?
I think you can.
Yeah. Or I would have bet my neck, we say in Spanish as well. I would have bet my neck that person would never do that or that or that. And sometimes not very serious things happen, but we all know, I think, even in childhood, we all know that feeling that, oh dear, this person has done this, or this person has betrayed me, or I feel this person has betrayed me. And afterwards, very often, after that happens, or we think that's happened, we come to think, oh, well, now I remember that on one occasion I saw something in this person which I didn't like, that made me mistrust this person. But that's after we know. And generally, when we see something we dislike or in someone we care about, we don't want to see that.
So we don't want to read the signs. I mean,
no.
It's kind of like...
No, we think, oh, he's having a bad day or she's having a bad day, or maybe it's my imagination. That's a useful thing.
The functioning of jealousy works like that.
Yeah, also.
When you become jealous...
Well, unless somebody's so jealous that he's wanting to... He's wishing to be jealous. There are people like that, too. But generally, yes, suspicion sometimes. What do you do with suspicion?
I don't know if you know this Belgian writer, Suzanne Lillard.
No.
I don't think she's very well known certainly not in the American-speaking world, and I don't even know if in Europe she's very well known. But I remember reading a line of hers a long time ago where she said that everything, particularly in a love affair, everything is visible immediately. Mm-hmm. It is there.
Yeah.
You know it.
Yes.
You can see the beginning, middle, and end.
Yeah.
But you look away.
I think she's rather right, yes. But to follow with that example, it's not only in love affairs, it's also... In this novel, Into Your Face Tomorrow, there are two characters that are based very clearly, and I never concealed it from two real people whose permission I asked. Now they're both dead, but they weren't when I started writing the book. One was my father, and the other one was Sir Peter Russell, an Oxford Don, with whom I had a very good friendship since I was teaching there in the 1980s, until his death about 4 years ago. And I used their part of their biographies for these two characters, the narrator's father and the character called Sir Peter Wheeler. And one of the things I used from my father is what happened to him, and what happened also to the father, to the narrator's father in the novel. Now it's also in the novel, of course. And it was that by the end of the Civil War in 1939, exactly only a fortnight after the war ended, which was a terrible moment for the losers of the war, for the defeated side, and of course Franco's people and Franco's troops and Franco police were just shooting people. He was denounced by, in principle, he didn't know by whom. and he was put to jail because in those times, of course, as in all dictatorships, a mere accusation was enough to bring someone to jail and probably to the firing squad at the time. And, of course, you had to prove your innocence, which is something that can't be done. But it's often forgotten that it can be done. It is the one accusing who must prove the guiltiness of someone. You can prove. If I say that Paul Holden-Graeber, for instance, yesterday morning killed a little lady on 27th Street, for instance, unless he has a good alibi for the moment, he can't demonstrate he did not do something. And if it is given to me the privilege of telling the truth in principle, whatever I say is true, then you would be in big trouble. So my father found out a little later that the man who had denounced him was his best friend for many years. They had been friends even in high school, and that's more or less in the first volume of the novel. There is a conversation which doesn't reproduce exactly any conversation I did have with my own father, but a similar one, or one I might have had. And of course, I asked him, "But didn't you foresee that? Didn't you anticipate that this man could do something of the sort?" He said, "Never." "And do you know why he did it?" "I don't know." Some people said envy, but that seems too poor an explanation for something so terrible as sending someone to death, because that meant normally go to the firing squad and in front of the firing squad. He was lucky then. He was in jail for a few months, and then, well, by a series of coincidences, he could go out. He was then retaliated during many, many years. He couldn't teach, which would have been the normal thing for him to do. He was the Spanish philosopher Ortega y Gasset's main disciple. He couldn't write in the newspapers until well into the 1950s and all that, but, well, he was lucky. He was not killed, and that's why I'm here.
But
how could you not see his face tomorrow? That's the thing. How could you not see his face tomorrow? I said, "I didn't. I couldn't." That happens, yes. We deceive ourselves, of course. I'm sure he could have seen something, maybe not something so serious and so terrible as that betrayal. But
and so that, in a sense, is the role of literature. To be able to write that which, in this particular case, your father couldn't see.
For instance, yes, sometimes. Or to think about it and to try to explain yourself. I don't know. I always write about, not always, because I started publishing when I was very, very young, and my first two novels mainly published when I was 19 and 21 respectively. They are different and they are sort of pastiches. And since 1983 or so, I've written only about things that worry me in life. I don't choose subjects because they look good or because, you know, many writers do that and they say, well, let's write a historical novel about this period because nobody has done it and it looks good, or I know a lot about this, or I'm going to talk about something which is of no particular interest to me, but it is for the people, for readership. I always write about the things that worry me, that concern me in my own life. And some of them, I am supposed, worry or concern everyone. Things like suspicion and secrecy and deceit and betrayal and, of course, loss and, of course, love and, of course, death and what happens to the dead and how we feel them. And all those things are in everyone's lives, even if some people don't want to think of some of them at all. but they are.
Do you enjoy reading obituaries?
No, not particularly. I mean, it depends on how well written is the piece.
Do you read them?
Sometimes. Depends on who died.
I'm a great lover of obituaries. I begin the day that way. And in one of the books that I truly, dearly love of yours is called Written Lives, where
yes.
you've written up the life of several writers, many writers. And it would seem that your subjects are chosen according to the passion you have for them, both positive and less positive passion you mm-hmm. feel for some of them. Most of them are celebrations of the writers in some form or fashion, I would say. But you choose your subjects both carefully, and you choose what you will write about these subjects very carefully.
Of course.
And give... And don't, in no form or fashion, you were talking earlier about the pain academics must feel when writing certain books. In this mm-hmm. particular case, you will very idiosyncratically write about a particular subject. I'm taking, for instance, the example of Thomas Mann.
Yes.
What you particularly feature quite abundantly in that piece is Thomas Mann's digestive system. And
well, because he devoted quite many pages in his diaries to that, and then I just mentioned that he did that. Yeah, well, that book, the idea was more or less the pieces are 7 pages long or something
at
like
most.
That. Yeah. And only, so they're very short, and they can be short biographies, not even short biographies, because they are too short. They are portraits, you could say, but the idea in my mind was to treat real authors as if they were characters, fictional characters. Because in the end, I think that... In the end, and I thought I was doing something not illegitimate, as it were, because I think that in the end, all writers wish to be fictional. And I thought, well, why don't I try to talk about them as if I was writing a short story about one character who happens to be Robert Louis Stevenson, or Nabokov, or Faulkner, or Conrad, or Conan Doyle, or Rimbaud, or whatever. Or Stern himself as well. And that's what I tried to do. And I was not interested in their work. I didn't talk at all about their work. And for instance, it's very clear that I don't like very much Thomas Mann as a personage. Which doesn't imply at all that I don't like his writing, which I do like very much, in fact, or James Joyce, for instance. But I chose, indeed, as you said, very carefully what to tell about them. And I decided that I would tell things that were apparently unimportant, such as, I remember the fact that Conrad smoked a lot and was burning everything all the time, particularly his bathrobe. He was wearing a bathrobe around the house very often, apparently. And then he was burning, he had this burnt bathrobe, which apparently he didn't change as much as he should have. And small, idiotic things, if you want. Idiotic. Thank you. Small idiotic things like the fact that when apparently he was such a nervous man that when his pen fell down to the floor, instead of just picking it up and go on, he got so nervous that he spent a long while doing like this before he picked it up, you know. And there are things like that here and there, and others more meaningful, perhaps. But I think that a portrait of all them comes out in the end, rather, acceptable as fictional characters too. And they are almost like short stories, I would say. I had great fun when I wrote
it's
that
apparent one. and the reader it's apparent and the reader has great fun reading them, which is, you know, one of the most salient parts of your writing is precisely its humor.
And this.
I think you attach a lot of importance to humor, and this may be one of the reasons why Thomas Mann doesn't feature very positively in this book, because he was not a barrel of laughter.
What I really cannot stand, I must say that, is authors who take themselves. I mean, you have to take if you write. It's better if you take your work seriously, more or less seriously. Try to do it as best you can. But to take yourself seriously because of that, it's something unbearable, in my opinion. And that's what Thomas Mann or James Joyce did, for instance. And that's why I don't like them very much as people. Whereas Conan Doyle or Stevenson didn't do that at all. And I certainly try not to, well, in my case, it's not trying. It's easy that I don't take myself seriously. In fact, one of my curses is, one of my curses is that I can never be satisfied with what I've done by the mere fact of having done it. I mean, if I finally finish a book, even if during the writing of that book I thought, oh dear, this is so difficult, the moment I have finished it, even as such a long one as Your Face Tomorrow, I have a feeling I have some disdain for it, and I said, well, if I did it, it was not so difficult. And if it was not so difficult, it has not so much merit. And then I can't ever be happy about what I've done. I can only be happy about what I haven't done, which is a curse, I assure you. But I can't take seriously anything, and certainly not and praise. Certainly not praise. I mean, I appreciate praise, as you remember what Gertrude Stein said about the three things writers needed.
Probably a repetition of three words. No.
Yeah.
Yeah. I would imagine.
Praise.
Yeah. Exactly.
That's what she said. But I've realized that's not enough. Because when you have praise, at least that's my own case, when I have praise, I say, oh, yes, well, thank you, I do appreciate it.
Thank you.
And it's stimulating and it's encouraging. I won't say it's not. But maybe they're praising for the wrong reasons. And probably they're exaggerating too. And
I have this feeling so often myself. In these particular conversations, people will come up to me after the conversation. They will say, that's the best conversation I've ever heard. And I always think to myself, my goodness, what kind of a life do they have? I mean, really.
Well, if anyone says that, they're probably just being polite.
Right. No. And I was not talking about tonight, of course.
Oh.
When you went off to Princeton, and I mentioned to you before going that being, as Barbara said, the school where I studied and taught a bit, there was a story about Thomas Mann, which mm-hmm. I think is true, or as mm-hmm. Italians say, se non è vero e ben trovato,
yep.
Is he was asked early in the war how German culture was doing and if it wasn't going down the tubes, and he said, German culture is wherever I am. And to some extent...
Isn't that to be envied?
I think so. Envied,
to think that way.
I would say envied, but not emulated.
No,
certainly not.
No, but I mean, if you really believe that, it was even with all the problems he had in his lifetime, which were quite a few. He must have been rather happy, in general. I mean, if you can think that, no.
You say in the introduction to Written Lives that these writers have something in common, and writers mostly do. And you've reiterated that in a wonderful piece that I read in The New Republic, that they have disastrous lives.
Many
they
of
have
them,
disastrous
yes.
lives, and you say in the New Republic piece, which was published maybe 6 or 7 months ago, that you are quite pleased that young people, young children today, are not looking to, they don't have as an aspiration to become a writer.
Well, you say? Today or in the past. I don't remember when I was a boy, I don't remember anyone saying, I want to be a writer. They wanted to be lion tamers or firemen or, you know, this kind of thing, not writers. But nowadays, yeah, I don't know. No, I think in the piece you're referring to, I think that what I said also was that normally films and novels on artists, not only on writers, but on all kinds of artists, present them usually as very hysterical and sometimes wrathful people, and certainly people who suffer great torments and drink a lot, and or they are junkies, or they beat up their wives. And I don't mean that that's not happened on some occasions, but certainly I think I said that more than that. I said about these people in the people I chose for that book, For Written Lives, that they were rather calamitous individuals. Not that their life was a disaster, which was in some cases, for instance, Malcolm Lowry or Mishima, for instance. He ended up beheaded, you know. So by his will, anyway, so maybe he was not so unhappy about that the moment before. And but they were rather calamitous, not very practical people. And Conrad was not very practical, for instance, with his cigarettes, and Faulkner himself was not very much. And but some of them are very nice in this book, and you can see that they were probably very nice people, most of them, I would say. So. The problem with films and novels on artists is that they usually present them as not very nice people, as, you know, tormented minds and angry people throwing things against their paintings, and
cutting ears,
of course. Well, that was true apparently, and you know, and Charlton Heston painting the Sistine Chapel very wrathfully, and Gregory Peck playing Scott Fitzgerald, which seems quite unbelievable, and almost beating up Deborah Carr. And, you know, it's always like that, and it's not always like that. I mean, not all authors are so nasty, I would say.
Actually, that particular book finishes with some pages devoted to a collection you have. A collection of postcards,
yeah.
Postcards of writers. You have about 200 of them.
Probably more by now.
What are you? Are you a collector, for that matter?
In general,
yeah,
of some things. Not of many, but of some things: books, DVDs, CDs, postcards. Sometimes, a few paintings. The ones I can afford.
What does this collection of postcards afford you?
I don't know. I wrote this piece that
perfect lines,
it's like an epilogue to the short biographies or whatever you want to call them, and in which in a few lines, that's just a few lines. I mention or I analyze the gesture of each writer, or the way they pose, the way they pose, or whom they look like, and it's a very brief thing, and of course you can't judge by a photograph, because we all know that photographs are just an instant, and it depends very much on the light and on the angle and everything, and so you can think something of someone and be totally wrong, but well. Yeah, you can see things too in a photograph. And that's why what I tried to see. I mean, I remember that Joseph Conrad said something about sailors. He said the aim of a sailor is always to see, because that's one of the biggest problems. When at sea, you don't see anything because of a gale or whatever. He said to see, and I think that's what we all aim at, to see things. And to see things also in faces again. And that's what I try to do in that epilogue.
It's again lives. Going back to the things that we don't see when we look at somebody.
Yeah, sometimes we do.
Nearly the excess of a person. Mm. You feel overcome by too many details and can't quite take them in.
Yeah, also one of the problems, of course, and that's mentioned also in Your Face Tomorrow, it's so long, the book's so long that so many things are mentioned here and there. But it's the fact that I think one of the reasons for TV's huge success ever since it was invented is that it allows us to look at people in a way that we can't ever look at anyone in real life. Because if I start looking at you the way I look at someone on the TV, you would say, come on, stop staring at me, Javier, or something. You can't do that. And at the same time, you're looking at me as well, so I can't be so impune, you say, in English?
You can't look at me with such impunity.
Impunity, yes. You don't have the adjective.
I think
we do have it.
No, we don't.
Again,
we have it
things,
now.
Things to be missed. Yeah, yeah. Things to be missed in a language. You look with absolute impunity, an impunity which is absolutely impossible in real life unless you're a peeping Tom or a voyeur.
Which is partly what your narrators can be.
They can
eavesdrop. They can look with great intensity. I think that's in mm-hmm. some way what a ghost does very well.
Absolutely.
You, after going to Princeton, you went to Yale.
Yes.
Yesterday, and you went back to the house where you lived, and you went back
yes.
to find it. So you went to see, in a sense, your face tomorrow. You went to see the
my face the day before
yeah,
yesterday.
Before yesterday. So
at least my face yesteryear. That's a good word.
Not bad. Tell me, what was the curiosity and what was the feeling in front of that?
Well, the curiosity was very simple. I was taken there for the second time in my life. I was taken to the United States when I was 4. The first time I was taken to the United States, I was only 1 month old. And
because your father was fleeing.
Yeah, my father was hired by Wellesley College. When I was born, and a few years later, in 1950, in the academic year of 55-56, he was hired by Yale University, and he was going to spend the whole academic year, so he decided he would bring along my mother and 4 children. And I was 4 then, and I think that my very first memory is, because 4 is approximately the age in which many people start having
memories
or keeping them. I think that my very, very first memories come from New Haven, precisely, and they are very neat. And I remember that my brothers and I loved it, because of course it was a new country and it was everything so different from Madrid, and there were squirrels and things, and and there was a dog. I remember there was a dog with whom we ran races with a hedge in the middle because it belonged to the neighbors. So I remember so many things from that period. And we loved it so much that when we came back to Madrid, you know how children are. They think that everywhere is around and nearby. And for years, we were asking our parents, when are we going back to New Haven? When are we going back to New Haven? But we never did.
So
So I was in New Haven yesterday. I happen to know the address because my father mentions it in his memoirs. He published his memoirs in the 1980s, and I knew it was. It was. So I went and yes, I was very moved. I must say, I was very, very moved. I can't be sure whether the house has not been painted with a different color. It was dark gray, which is slightly strange, perhaps, and I'm not sure it was like that 50-odd years ago. But
your point exactly about what we remember. Your point exactly about the paucity of memory that we don't...
Yeah, absolutely. Well, of course, it was also slightly melancholic visit, in a way, because I couldn't help thinking... Of my parents. They are both now dead, and I thought also, well, probably my father went to work, take him this way, and yeah, that was a long time ago, of course. But
the American,
you know, I always think that time is deposited in space. It's space. The space is the keeper of time gone, of time that is gone. You go back to a place, and all of a sudden, something so remote as that comes to you with a... Proust wrote a lot about that, of course. Comes with a enormous strength, and all of a sudden, you see yourself with when you were 4 years old. It's not that I had forgotten. Because as I said, I have many memories of that period. But I said, I'm here again. I had this feeling. I'm here again, and it's incredible because it was as if I remember there was a garage in the backyard or something, and I went towards that because we played in that backyard, and we were afraid of the garage. We didn't enter the garage. I said, maybe my eldest brother said, there is a man there, you know, that kind of thing. And so we didn't go there, but we...
Peeped.
And I had the impulse to go there and peep. So it's very strange. It's very strange. And I think it's space. Space is where time is deposited sometimes.
I somehow have so many more questions, but I'd love to end on that note. Thank you very much.
Good, thank you. Thank you.
A couple of questions. If there are some, there's a mic.
The future of the book. You mean the printed book?
Is that important to you?
Yeah, to me, yes. But I'm a dinosaur, you know. I don't know what will happen. I suppose that if the e-book or whatever it's called or it's going to be called is really successful, which I don't know if we can assure as yet. I suppose that in about 20 years' time, there will be a generation that has been used to that, and that because of that, they won't even miss printed books. And that may happen, of course. I don't know. I like to think that actual books, as we know them, won't disappear. They shall coexist in the worst of cases. I'd like to think that, but I can't know. And something else is the problem of the copyright and all that, which is maybe too complicated. And on the other hand, I don't even use a computer, so
You write on a typewriter.
Yeah, I write on a typewriter and I correct by hand. And so I'm not very well informed about all that problem, but that could be a big problem for writers, I suppose, if the same thing started to happen as it's happened with songs and films and TV series and all that. I wrote recently one of my columns in El País, Sunday columns I've been writing for many years, about that, and I said that, when my generation was young, many people, many students stole one book now and then from a bookshop. Let's not deny it. And most people, well, it was the 70s on the one hand, on the other hand, I remember one thing that was important. We thought that we weren't ruining anyone, because one book here and there, even for a bookseller, was not a great tragedy. And we were very aware that we weren't stealing from the author, because an author gets paid for every book.
Stolen or not.
Stolen or not. We were stealing from the bookseller, yes, and also maybe from the publisher, but the publisher was, you know, a very powerful man in principle and all that, but not from the author, and that was important to us. And something has changed in this respect. I mean, nowadays many people think that we are more virtuous than we were in the 70s, for instance, but we're not in some respects. Many young people nowadays don't care about stealing from authors or from composers or from any kind of artists. And if that should go on and on and on, they are acting more or less like the insatiable hunter who endangers a species by hunting it. Because there could be a moment, not next year and not probably in 10 or 20 years' time, in which writers wouldn't write books anymore and composers wouldn't compose any songs. Because when some people nowadays tell you, but don't you feel flattered that so many people are interested in what you did to a composer or something? And I said, well, that's not enough. Praise is not enough. Once again, and we live on that. We somehow live or try to live on that. And that's something people don't realize anymore. But that's another problem.
I remember when I was growing up in Europe and in France, one year Le Monde did a survey of which book had been stolen the most.
The most.
And that particular year, it was a book that surprised the writers of Le Monde because it was fairly big, so people needed to probably have a big coat.
You remember?
I do, of course I remember it. I don't remember if I stole it myself, but it was a 100 Years of Solitude, which
I see.
At one point was very much stolen.
Yeah. In French, I suppose, not in Spanish.
In those years, yeah. There's a mic, a couple more questions.
You said that you almost didn't finish this final volume. Could you tell us what the issue was, or why?
Why you couldn't finish this final volume? Was it the final volume of your novel? You couldn't fit, you thought that you might not be able to finish it. And why did that come about?
Well, for several reasons. One of them is that 8 years, or maybe 8-9 years, is a long time in anybody's life, and in it's more in a middle-aged man's life, as I am. So you don't even know sometimes whether you're going to live to finish something that's going to take you, in principle, so many years, even if I didn't know it was going to take me so long. In fact, when I did publish the first volume and I had interviews and I was interviewed in Spain and all that, I talked about a second volume. I didn't even know there was going to be a third one by then. On the other hand, as I don't work with a computer, I can't do this thing that apparently computers do very easily, which is, for instance, where did I use the word rain in throughout 1,500 pages? And then you press a button and you know. Isn't it so? Well, I don't have that. So I had opened so many things in the novel. And on the other hand, I had published two volumes from which I couldn't change anything because they were already published. So if I had made a mistake in those volumes, I had to stick to the mistake in the third volume. And I was thinking, oh dear, how shall I close all this? Because I've been opening and opening and opening and opening things and elements and stories and digressions and all that, and how shall I do it? And on the other hand, you know, this kind of thing, did I say that this man's eyes were gray or did I say they were blue and where did I say it? And I was leafing through the volume first and then volume second. And in fact, there was a moment in which there is half a page that does exist because I made a mistake only. And then I had to write something to amend that mistake that I couldn't change because volume one and two were already published. So reasons enough to doubt that I could finish the whole thing. And there was a blood stain. There was a famous blood stain in the first volume, and I hadn't yet decided what that blood stain was going to be. I decided very much on the spot. And as I've said on several occasions, I write in a rather suicidal way, in which I never change what I wrote in page 10 or 50, even if it would be convenient to change it when I'm writing page 400. I stick to what I wrote, and I follow, when writing, the same principle of knowledge that rules life. That is, when you're 40 or you're 50, you can wish that at 20 you had done something that you didn't, or that you had married someone else, or that you had chosen a different job, or whatever, but you had to stick to what you did and try to make it somehow necessary and try to... And I do that in a novel. Of course, not doing it is the normal thing, and it's perfectly legitimate, but I do it this way. I don't know exactly why. And then I improvise, and I decide, and I write many things without knowing where they're going to lead me to. I've often said that some writers write with a map. I write only with a compass. I know where I'm heading for, more or less, but I don't know if I will have to cross a desert and a cliff and a jungle and what. Whereas the other writers who know the whole story before beginning, they know they will have to cross the jungle and the desert and the river and the cliffs, but they already knew when they started because they had this map and they knew the whole thing. I don't.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.